All right, here we go. Are you ready?
Here we go.
I guess.
Welcome to M Vibes Podcast.
Home of good music,
good libations,
and good vibes. All right, welcome back to another episode of M Vibes Podcast. This is Javier.
This is Eric.
And you will not be hearing Amanda's lovely voice
yeah,
today.
Yeah, Amanda dissed us today, man, and that's all right.
She broke up with us.
Yeah.
Amanda will be back. She just had to work tonight.
Yeah. No, actually, she's not working tonight. She's doing something else that's more fun than the podcast, I guess.
What is it?
Yeah, she worked today. She was brewing today.
She had
some kind of event tonight.
She said she had plans.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, plans.
Hey, I'm supposed to be in Asheville right now, but I'm doing the podcast, so...
Ooh.
It's okay.
It's all right.
Priorities, Amanda. Priorities, Amanda.
All right. Well, let's go over what we're drinking today.
All right.
And let's start with you, Ernest.
Oh, let's see. I'm having, Redwood Empire.
Rye whiskey.
Emerald Giant Rye whiskey. Yeah, this is it's excellent. It's very light.
Yeah, this stuff is super cool. Like you said, it's not super heavy. It's pretty cool. We got it on a trip to Chicago. You were with me when I got this.
Oh, really?
I got this in Chicago, yeah.
Oh, well, I may have to try it. Oh, yeah. Now that I see the label.
Yep.
Now, yeah, okay.
So where are they out of?
Chicago, I think.
No, they're out of Sonoma County, California.
Oh, shit. Sorry.
Okay. California rye whiskey. Okay. And speaking of California, I'm also drinking Lagunitas Hazy Wonder. It's a fascinating ferment full of fabulous Sabro, Citro, and Cashmere hops for a smooth tropical fruitness. Slightly bitter, densely hazy phenomenon that's strangely light in mouthfeel, keeping you satiated and still coming back for more.
Mm.
What?
Awesome.
What are you drinking, Eric?
I am drinking. So I had some beer shipped to me from Seattle. It came from Haze, a gluten-free hazy IPA from Ghostfish Brewing. And to complement this, I'm drinking a train's coming by. And
yeah, if you hear the train throughout, we're recording at my house today. Yeah. There's a train track like there's right my ride. Next door. Yeah.
I got to go.
The hobos are all hopping on the train. Yeah. I'm also drinking Jameson Black Barrel. So this stuff's good.
Yeah, I'm going to try it.
I love that Black Barrel.
I've never tried it. I'm going to try that next. I am drinking Lagunitas IPA out of Petaluma, California, specifically. And I'm also having a few fingers of the Redwood Empire because this is one of the things that I have. I like a lot. I like whiskeys. My house is filled with bourbon and whiskey. So,
have you done anything cool this week or since we did our last podcast?
Nah, man. No. I was sick all of last week.
That's right. You were sick for a while. Yeah.
I was sick all of last week and didn't do anything. And then this week it's just been playing catch up at work. So it's just, no, I haven't done anything.
Well, I went to Florida and went to Universal Studios with the family. That was fun. Unfortunately, well, it's kind of cool, but I was kind of bummed out. Saw through social media, Scott Ian from Anthrax was at Universal the same time I was there. I'm kind of bummed I didn't see him, but it's probably a good thing because I would have totally geeked out.
If I saw him.
Yeah, it's Scott Ian. Oh my God.
Yeah, the last live show. Oh, no, actually, okay, so now I remember.
I've gone to two shows since last time we did a podcast.
Yeah, the only thing I've done is that Beethoven with Hannah.
Yeah, I went and saw Clutch.
Oh, that's right.
And I went and saw Leon Bridges, which were both great shows. Clutch was phenomenal. That was a great show. The Sword opened for them. They're like a jam band metal type of thing, man. That shit's awesome.
That sounds good.
And Leon Bridges was most laid back show I've ever been to.
He's pretty laid back anyway.
He is. Even more laid back than James Taylor, which.
I was getting ready to say, is it like a James Taylor show, a slideshow, or what?
You know, I'll be honest, it's no secret. I can't stand James Taylor. I did go to a show with my wife. I did enjoy myself that night, but I'll never go again. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, this podcast is pretty epic, man. I'm kind of pumped about this one.
Yeah. It's, I think, you know, once we did our research, we kind of figured out that
there's a lot to talk about. So
yeah, we bit a little more than we can chew in one episode. So we're just gonna do
the early days of
Def Jam Recordings.
Def Jam Recordings. You know, I used to call it Def Jam Records, and if you go to look it up, the first thing it says is it's not Def Jam Records; it's Def Jam Recordings. So a lot to talk about.
Yeah. So
let's go on a journey, man. Let's go back to 19. It's conflicting. 83 or 84. I'm going to say 84. 1984.
Well, yeah. So a lot of this stuff is obviously Def Jam Recordings started before Def Jam Recordings started.
It wasn't called that. It was Crush Groove or whatever you want to call it. They recorded a bunch of stuff before they actually named it Def Jam. So
yeah, actually it goes back to him being in high school. So you know, starting off with Rick Rubin, because obviously, you know, I think we both agreed, and I think anybody who listens to music and kind of pays attention to the industry, one of the greatest, most genius producers,
absolutely,
hands down. All time, right? Like Rick Rubin is a fucking genius. He grew up in a very musical household, by his own account, you know, but he also grew up with some very popular music growing up, right? Some of his earlier music, you know, primarily the Beatles, the Monkees, that's sort of the stuff that he grew up with. One of the interesting things that I read very early on is that he didn't care much for me as far as producing or making music. He wanted to be a magician.
You know, I didn't know that. Wow. Okay.
So not really sure what happened to that. Focus, that was just more fun. Yeah. But obviously, you know, on his own, and you can see once he started kind of signing some of the bands later on, he primarily gravitated towards heavy metal, right? Heavy rock, some punk, but primarily punk. Heavy metal. Then eventually he just moved straight into the punk scene. He actually, which is kind of funny that you said that earlier, he started out musically by being the guitar player for a punk band called The Pricks. That was in the early 80s, way before like Def Jam.
That sounds punk, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, he had played before like in you know, like high school bands and whatnot, but The Pricks was his actual first band. I did see some like flyers and stuff while I was doing research. Pretty cool stuff. Couldn't find any music. Their claim to fame as The Pricks is that they were thrown out of CBGB.
That's awesome.
So, hey, you know.
You have to do something major to get tossed out of there.
Yeah.
Actually, I think if you did more than one cover, you were tossed out. So,
really?
As a band, yes. Because there were signs on the wall that say no covers. It's actually at the Milestone, too, but everyone still does covers. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, he's from New York native. So he started noticing and falling in love with hip hop, you know, very early on, first in Long Island, which is where he's from. Then after that, he moved to Manhattan at one point in his early life. And, you know, obviously he was hearing it there constantly. Mm-hmm. But at the time, you know, he was still a punk kid. And then he went on to form a band called Hosts. And he recorded their first album on a 4-track recorder at his high school in 1982. And that was the first record ever that actually featured the Def Jam logo as we know it today.
Really?
Yeah. So this was in 82. So Def Jam has been around since at least 82, and that logo has existed since at least 82.
It was probably him that started the name before he even met.
Yeah. Oh, Russell, yeah. Absolutely. Okay, right. Oh, yeah. No, and that's very well known. He had Def Jam way before Russell came in the picture. So, it was just like him out of his dorm, though.
Right. And that's when Jazzy Jeff introduced him to Russell Simmons. Right. Am I going way too fast there?
That's fine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whatever. Oh, yeah, that did happen.
Yeah, it did. DJ Jazzy Jeff, like way before all the fame and all that stuff. But yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that first record, it was a 45 7-inch single. And all I had was like a brown paper bag. That was like their entire thing. And included some original songs. But I think because I did find it, I did track it down and I heard it. And I know we're not playing it. But he had some like covers, some punk covers of songs like Super Freak by.
I would love to hear that, actually.
And, You Sexy Thing by Hot Chocolate. I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool. Yeah, it's easier to find. Just do a search on it. Maybe we'll add it to the
actually, playlist. There were a lot of songs that were not on Spotify for this playlist.
I did notice that too. Yeah. Actually, as Hoes, which is kind of cool, they actually went on to become fairly significant. They went and toured with the Meat Puppets, Circle Jerks, the Butthole Surfers, and Minor Threat, among a bunch of other people. So, you know, whatever. So they did this band around 1984, which is when he started shifting his focus towards hip hop. And then, you know, he started running Def Jam. So the demands of running the record label, obviously, just he couldn't record and tour anymore. So that's what you were saying earlier, right? Yeah. That, you know, Def Jam started way earlier than we thought. And after, you know, I thought it was 1984, but based on this, obviously he had it since 82, but the official, like sort of the way we know Def Jam today is, he started in his, dorm room, at, Weinstein Hall
in NYU. College. Yeah.
That was dorm room 712. And there's a cool documentary out there. If you guys want to go look at it, where like he goes back 20 years later to go visit his old dorm. And there's a little graffiti of like, that says Rick was here. And then he like tagged right over it. Rick was also here, or Rick was here again, or some shit like that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
I saw when he did the episode of, what's that Letterman show? Oh man, we're in trouble.
I do live in a neighborhood that's surrounded by So
I think they're parking right out front. Hold on. Oh, okay. False alarm.
You know you live in the city.
Yeah, that's Charlotte's finest.
Yes.
Station 7.
You know they have their own calendar. They only hire like they kind of like the Hooters of firefighters. They only hire like the hottest ones.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the art district.
Yes. Yeah.
My youngest daughter said, "Dad, are we city people or country people?" I said, "We're city people."
A little bit from column A, a little bit from column B.
She goes, "Yes, that was right.
Solid suburb."
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah. So within a year of him sort of starting this in his dorm, they actually got a label deal with Columbia Records, which is pretty impressive, really. His dorm room became Def Jam's offices for years. Like, it wasn't like, oh, he like moved out his beds and everything. And that's where he made his office and the whole recording studio and everything. At the time he started, he didn't know anything about the record industry like at all. No. It was just some kid who wanted to release records. But he did used to hang out around this record store called 99 Records, which I was hoping is still there. I don't think it is anymore, but that record store also released their own albums, and that's where he learned about, you know, the process of making records and whatnot. The one thing I did want to mention about the logo, which I kind of did not know, which, you know, given the story I just told, doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but this is something that I did read. Apparently, the very large D and the J on the Def Jam logo is to sort of recognize the importance of the role that DJs play in hip hop. But again, given that story that I just told, that the record label started back in, at least he had the idea of this record label since 82 on a punk band, and that logo was already around, that seems like an afterthought. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it may have just been like, hey, we can add this and that, and then, oh, check it out, it works, you know?
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about Russell Simmons now, because he's the other big component of this part, right? And then we'll go into the actual music and what they release and whatnot. So Russell Simmons, if you don't know Russell Simmons, just like if you don't know Rick Rubin, I mean, you have to know Russell Simmons.
One of the godfathers of hip-hop.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hands down. So around this time, when he already had that Columbia deal and all that, that's when Russell Simmons came in the picture. He was already an established record producer by the time he met Rick Rubin.
He did a bunch of Run DMC albums, Curtis Blow.
Yeah. Curtis Blow primarily. I mean, that was the first one that blew up for him.
Yeah.
He had been, you know, already, but again, by the time he got to Def Jam, he had already been an important figure in the rap music scene for at least 5 years before, you know, he joined Def Jam. Also a New York native, like Rick Rubin. Both of his parents were very active in the arts and civil rights movement. So that's kind of a lot of interview. If you listen to him talk, you know, you can hear that definitely. He moved to Hollis, to the Hollis neighborhood, where he, this is Russell Simmons we're talking about, because if you look at him today, he's such, this caught me off guard, really. But he apparently joined the Seven Immortals gang, and I used to follow a lot of the New York back in the day gangs. There's documentaries and stuff, and I was fascinated by it. But apparently he did join Seven Immortals, just one of the New York gangs back in the 70s. But anyway, that's really neither here nor there.
That's not in the Crush Crew movie, man. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm joking.
Crush Crew with Law. So obviously he started music promotion at a very early age. Nobody really attended his first show, allegedly. So he kind of found himself broke. So his mom fronted him about $2,000. And with that money, he founded Rush Productions, which is the record label he had before Def Jam. Yep. Right. So this was his own project.
And that's where he produced the first Run DMC album.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, the first, let's not say album. The first Run DMC track.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he did. But the big thing that like really hit it big for him was the 1979 Curtis Blow album.
Yes.
Christmas Rap, or the song Christmas Rapping, but it wasn't that album. Yeah. From there, you know, once that happened, obviously he started adding some pretty impressive fucking names to his company. Houdini, like you said, Run DMC, Jimmy Spicer. Like, he really established himself as a record producer. As he started becoming more and more involved with Def Jam and sort of Rick Rubin's visions and sounds, which blew him away, really, because he was fascinated by Rick Rubin's sort of methodology and how he approached primarily hip-hop, obviously. He eventually sort of abandoned Rush Records to make Def Jam his main project. Also, by attaching his name to Def Jam, Def Jam pretty much immediately became a legit record company just by having Russell Simmons' name associated with it.
Right. So,
yep.
So, when those two met, when Jazzy Jeff introduced Rick Rubin to Russell Simmons, he's like, "Hey, man, this is the dude that produced that track that you like so much, man. La Trim, was it? Yeah.
For the T La Rock and Jesse J?
Yes. That was the first track that that put Rick Rubin on the map. And so when Jazzy Jeff brought that to him, he's like, "Yo, man, this is the dude that made that." And he showed him all these extra beats, all these new beats that he had on his 808 board.
Right.
And that's how it kind of started, man. He's like, "All right, you know, this dude's got some stuff underneath his belt, man.
Yeah.
He's got some cool ass shit. Maybe we should start doing something." Yes.
The beginning, the intro to the song is fucking amazing.
Yes.
Commentating, illustrating, description giving, adjective expert, analyzing some of the musical myths, seeking people of the universe. This is yours.
So this was the first album released under officially Def Jam Recordings. Right. It was called It's Yours. It's by T La Rock. He's the DJ. And I'm sorry, it's the MC and Jesse J. This was released in January 28th of 1984. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why they started releasing stuff like this is because Rick's original idea was to release music. He was actually hearing in the hip hop and rap clubs at the time, right? Like, most of the go ahead.
Like, a lot of the rap acts that were coming out at the time were just using like R&B tracks
with some guy rapping over
with some with exactly. Rick Rubin came up with his own beats,
right? Exactly,
and so, brought up something new and something different, which is totally to me punk rock. This is
absolutely
is fucking awesome.
This is what gave hip-hop that punk rock itch, right? But yeah, you're absolutely right. Rick Rubin's problem with your Eric. Rick Rubin's problem with,
we both have beards, sorry.
problem with what he was hearing on the record is, think of like, you know, Grandmaster Flash or Melly Mel and the Furious Five and Rapper's Delight and all that shit. To him, that was not rap, yeah, right?
Rapper's Delight sampled what? Chic?
Right, so it was
good times. Yeah, right.
So it was R&B with somebody rapping over it, but that's not what was happening in the clubs and in the house parties. Right. In the house parties, there were pretty much just, it was a DJ scratching over beats, and you know, think like the big thing is like Dougie Fresh to me has always been kind of like what exemplified that early,
yes,
at least mainstream. Right, I know there's more, but Dougie Fresh to me sort of exemplified that early.
Dougie Fresh is us when I think of hip hop, that's as far back as I can go with, like, as far as raw hip hop.
Yeah. So this album again was the first one they ever released. They really didn't, you know, he got them together. He got Tila Rock and Jesse J together to make this album. So after listening to the album, Russell Simmons asked Jesse J to introduce him to the producer of the album, right? Yeah. Like, who produced this shit? Who made this shit happen? This is amazing. And Rubin. Then, eventually he ended up meeting Rick Rubin. And there's some, you know.
And it was funny because he met him. He's like, nah, this ain't the dude.
He's like, he's like, he's not the expletive who recorded this album or who produced
it.
Like,
he is.
He's like, that's him. He's like, no, he's not. He's like, yes, he is. So that was great. I mean, this is like a nerdy, long hair, metal looking, you know.
Yeah.
Kid from college, so
I mean, Rick, I think Russell was 27 and Rick Rubin was 21 when they met, and when I was 21, I was not thinking about doing that shit. I was concerned about how much beer I can get in my belly when I was 21. So
as they started collaborating and working and getting to know each other more, then that, you know, Russell Simmons, that's when he made the decision that they really should partner.
Yeah.
And not only that Def Jam's, obviously Def Jam Recordings had a lot more meat to chew on than Rush.
Right.
So that's when he's just like, all right, this is where we need to be. So.
And they got together and they met a dude named LL Cool J. And the first track they actually produced out on Def Jam and put out on vinyl was, what was that song?
There it is. You have to know this off the top of your head.
I do.
I need a beat.
Yeah.
I need a beat.
But he did a remix to it. And this is the remix. This is the Rick Rubin remix.
Yeah, so the way LL Cool J sort of came into the picture is, you know, after the release of It's Yours, which became a pretty big underground hit.
And then after that, they put out the album Beatbox, and I Need a Beat became the single off of that.
Right.
I'm sorry.
You're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, so once they released the album, a lot of local aspiring rappers started sending out their demo tapes to Def Jam Recordings.
Right.
And you know what that address was? Rick Rubin's dorm room. So they started getting flooded in his dorm room with all these demo tapes and in Weinstein Hall in his dorm. Here's one of the cool things that I found out. One of the people who sent their demo tapes was obviously LL Cool J, because that's who we're talking about right now, so obviously that's a given. But what's more interesting to me is that at that time, Adam Horovitz, who we better know as Ad Rock from the Beastie Boys, was actually spending a lot of time in Rick's dorm at that point, kind of helping him out and doing stuff like that. And it was actually him who found the LL demo and brought it to Rick Rubin.
That's
Ad Rock technically is the one who discovered LL Cool J.
See, that's because there's a lot of things that say that he already had the Beastie Boys going before he joined Def Jam.
He did. He did.
Okay. All right. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. But so, no, he didn't. The Beastie Boys were a thing before and they joined. We're going to go over that in the next one.
He was
one.
Part of the band, though, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, okay, he was. Yes, he was. And that's sort of what we're going after after LL. But yeah. So it was actually Ad Rock from Beastie Boys who found the record, who found the demo tape, LL demos tape, and brought it to Rick Rubin.
You know what? I'll be honest. Early LL stuff, to me, is it's in my heart, man. Bigger and Deafer, that whole album.
Yes.
I'm Bad. Of course, I Need Love is on that. I'll never forget it. When I was a kid, I went to Universal Studios, and I went in the booth, and I recorded that.
Wow.
I rapped over it at the recording studio. I was like 16, I think, man. It was awful. It was terrible. I got made fun of so bad. I was like, I don't know why I even bothered with that. But
it builds character. You're fine.
It did. But that first album, I still have it. It's still on vinyl in my house. It's in terrible shape, but I still have it. I've never thrown away anything. I'm sorry. I threw away one thing. African Bambaataa. But
wait, why?
We will go there later.
African Bambaataa is a
shit. He's a child molester.
Oh, that's true, too.
Yeah, I threw it all. I cracked him over my knee and threw him in the trash can, man. Yeah, sorry.
Well, no, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't actually own
it. Dude, I had. It was a 4-record set of every remix of Planet Rock. Oh. It was worth like $100. I could have sold it and just be done with it. But I said, you know what? I don't want anyone to have this shit. Cracked it over my knee, threw it in the trash can.
So, that's okay. White Lines is a way better song than it is, Planet Rock. Yeah. So after hearing his demo, LL Cool J was invited to the dorm, which was the House of Def Jam recording studio.
He walked in like, what the fuck is this?
So they decided to make records together.
Yeah.
Obviously, as you said earlier.
He was 17.
Yeah, he was very young. The first record they released together was Anita Beat, which is what we're listening to. Yep. And this was in 1984. This is sort of what launched also Def Jam into like massive success, right? That 12-inch single went on to sell 100,000 copies, which helped cement Def Jam as a respected label company. This was also the first time that Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons actually worked together officially as Def Jam Recordings. So that was pretty cool. Yeah. So what's next? Beastie Boys.
Beastie Boys.
Who I still love are still one of my hands down.
Here we go. Yeah. This record, I'll never forget when this came out, man. Everybody and their brother, we're all bought this record, man. It's still, to this day, one of the baddest hip-hop records of all time. And it's clearly a Rick Rubin album. As much like metal, like 70s metal, he sampled this, like Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin and all that shit he sampled. Man, this record's classic, dude. I mean... And the bass lines in this album. God almighty, if you got some bass in your car. Listen, listening to music or listening to this album on some ear pods does it no justice.
No.
You got to have the bass. Yeah. You got to have bass to it.
What I always liked about this track is that they were utilizing that backwards.
I was going to say,
The backwards beat.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think as most people... should know, the Beastie Boys started out as a punk band, not a rap or hip-hop group. They like I said earlier, they were already established by the time they came to Def Jam. They actually had a song called Cookie Puss, which is a pretty experimental underground record. The whole thing is, the song is what made it big, but the whole pretty experimental, not quite rap, but definitely very rap
right. And influence. They came out to Russell Simmons dressed in like matching sweatsuits, and Russell Simmons is like, "Listen, that's not your look."
Right.
He's like, "I want you guys to dress how you actually dress every day," and that's the Beastie Boys. And they came out, and they did, man. And that, you know, people latched onto it, man. It worked out for him.
So that original record, the one that they had before Def Jam, again, was already fairly successful. Two of the kind of cool little factoids that I found about that album is that it was actually the first release with Ad Rock. And it was also their last release with Kate Schellenbach.
I was going to say, I thought there was one more guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kate Schellenbach was the original drummer. She went on to become famous on her own right by being the drummer for Luscious Jackson. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
And the Lunatics.
With my naked eye, I see.
So she actually started out with the Beastie Boys.
Didn't they do a Beastie Boys cover? I swore they did. No, they were on his label.
Likely.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like a Royal...
So Royal Crown, whatever it was. Yeah. Once they got their own branch off of Def Jam, which, as you'll hear later on, there was a lot of branch offs from Def Jam.
Yeah. So, you know, from that, you know, Rick Rubin and the Beastie Boys came to work together when the Beastie Boys asked them to be their DJ once it kind of became a lot more sort of hip-hop rap influence. And that, you know, kind of was what led them jumping ship and joining Def Jam. But yeah, they had been friends for a while. But like Def Jam didn't make the Beastie Boys. The Beastie Boys didn't make Def Jam. They were all two separate entities that were already fairly okay and established by the time they joined forces. The second single that Def Jam ever released was Beastie Boys Rock Hard, also in 1984.
And that is not on Spotify.
That is not on Spotify.
Yeah, you'll find it on YouTube. Yeah. But it's still a dope jam, though, man. It's solid, yeah.
But you can find Cookie Puss, which is a lot more obscure, which is weird, right?
Yeah.
So then, you know, from that single, they went on to release License to Ill 2 years later in 1986, which is hands down one of the best fucking albums ever.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, which is what we just heard. So that also became the first rap LP to top the Billboard album charts. In any way, there hadn't been any...
Run DMC kind of did it. They kind of started it. They kind of had, you know, they were on the list, but... Beastie Boys went to number one.
Well, it was so massive that License to Ill a year later in 85 went on to be certified platinum.
Yep.
Then 2015 it was certified diamond, which holy fuck. I mean, you're talking a bunch of fucking kids from New York, skateboarder punks have a platinum selling album, right? That's more than 10 million units sold of that album. That's what that
album is. A classic, and it always will be, man.
So
you will hear fire engines in the background.
Guys, I live in the city.
Okay? You know what, though? Sorry. It's perfect for
you can tell it's Friday night.
Yeah. Hey, it's perfect for the Def Jam episode, man. So,
after we finish recording, we might get arrested ourselves.
If we were in, Brooklyn doing this episode, you hear the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So here's where sort of like the bad news kick in for the collaboration or the partnership between Beastie Boys and Def Jam.
Recording their own stuff, yeah. So Rubin went one way?
Well, I'm talking about the Beastie Boys, yeah.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Still, yeah. So after that follow-up tour for License to Ill, Def Jam, and again, there was a documentary about the Beastie Boys that released a couple years ago, and this is kind of where it all came to light. Def Jam apparently wanted to pigeonhole them into kind of like a bunch of quote unquote clown shit, which I get it, like license, like fight for your, you know,
fight right to party,
fight for your to party type stuff, and send them right back on tour. And the Beastie Boys producer were like, not really, that's great and all, but like we're more than that. So unfortunately that soured their relationship to the point where the label Def Jam started holding royalties from License to Ill from the Beastie Boys. This was at the behest of Columbia, not necessarily them, right? This really led to a pretty serious falling out between Def Jam and the Beastie Boys. That documentary I was mentioning earlier is an Apple TV only. The only reason why.
Yeah, because after that, they came out with Paul's Boutique.
And then after watching the documentary, Russell himself expressed some regret about how he handled the entire situation and wish he had done better. So,
and Paul's Boutique was a classic in itself. It doesn't have the classic tracks that License to Ill does, but if you go back and listen to it now, samples and the things that they use in that album are fucking phenomenal, man. And they learned a lot from. There we go. They learned a lot from Rick Rubin on how to sample things. So,
all right. So, who came next? Slayer.
Well, Slayer did. No, well, wait. There was some other stuff. That's when they started going their own ways, man. So, Rick Rubin went with Slayer, and Russell Simmons went with Orange Juice Jones.
Yes,
The Rain. So that was, and Orange Juice Jones, I'll never forget. I was telling Javi earlier, Slayer, I got a sample, vinyl sample of all of Def Jam's artists back when I was in high school. I found it for used like a promo copy in some music shop I used to go into in Detroit called Music. Yeah, this table may fall over soon. Sorry. It's all right.
So, for the record, this is not The Rain by Orange Juice Jones, but...
No, it's not. It's
very similar.
It's okay, though. This is Rick Rubin's the venture on Def Jam.
Yeah, so Slayer, another band that came into the label that was already fairly established. Why do you keep moving the table?
I don't. I just lean on it, and it moves. I'll stop leaning on the table. This table's going to fall over at any moment, guys.
No, it's not. My table kicks ass. Stop. Yeah, so Slayer, again, was already an established band who had already released albums on their own with Metal Blade. Metal Blade is a very, very established record label themselves. But with Def Jam, they were giving a much larger budget to work with than Metal Blade ever gave them. So this allowed them to, you know, make a much better and clearer production than anybody else.
It was weird to come out on Def Jam with
Slayer. Which was known as a hip-hop family.
I don't think anyone really noticed to say, hey, you know, Slayer's on Def Jam. Certainly no one in hip-hop noticed Slayer was on Def Jam because no one in hip-hop listened to Slayer. That didn't come until later on in the days, but I'll tell you what, though. That was me back in high school. Slayer and LL Cool G, if we could make playlists back in 1984, that would have been in my playlist.
Yeah.
Back then, so it was a bunch of vinyl.
We'd record on cassette tapes.
Right. We would have to record off the radio. Yeah.
And you double-decker off the radio. Boombox.
But most of the time, you wouldn't hear either one of those on the radio.
You would not hear Slayer on the radio.
Speaking of, that's funny that you say that because, yeah, I mean, this was the third album following Hello 8.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was the distributor for Def Jam, which, again, was Columbia Records, who were also the ones who told them to fucking hold royalties from Beastie Boys, refused to release the album due to the song Angel of Death.
Yes. Which is the opening song, right?
Technically, yeah. Technically agree, because it detailed sort of the life and the horrors of a Holocaust concentration camp at the hands of Joseph Mengele, which was known as Dr. Death. He's the one who experimented on living human beings, obviously Jewish people, just to do what? I have a hard time talking about it, but
well, they were considered less than human,
right?
So, I mean, they were considered.
This is actually a perfect
lab rats,
right?
To transition into Orange Juice Jones with The Rain.
So as a result, because of Columbia's issues, this album was actually released through Geffen Records, not through Columbia, in 86. So,
but that's the directions that they both went into, and it's good that they did because it kind of changed up how they were going to release albums later on down the road. So. I don't know if anyone knows. There you go. Russell Simmons and Run from Run DMC are brothers.
Yep.
And Russell Simmons produced like the first two or three Run DMC tracks. Not albums, just singles. They Run DMC never signed to Def Jam. They were never on Def Jam at all. They're always on Priority Records.
So Orange Juice was the first musician also to be signed to OBR Records, which is a subsidiary of Def Jam. Right. It stood for Original Black Recordings, and it primarily catered to R&B artists, which is sort of where this comes in. Because again, by this point, they had already released some hip-hop albums, some rap albums, and a metal album, right?
So, right.
I love this fucking song.
This, you know what? And then, what's his face? Action Bronson sampled this for the Suicide Squad soundtrack. It's pretty dope. And him.
Yeah, and I think this is the only thing that Orange Juice really did.
It was.
He kind of did a couple more albums, but they all failed to have any.
This was it.
Yeah. He did do a couple of collabs in the porn industry.
Oh, really?
That's about the only thing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's about the only other thing he did. Yeah.
Did they use this song in the background?
I don't know.
This would be perfect for porn.
I mean, I'm sure he didn't do porn. I think he just did the music to something or other.
I thought you said he did porn.
No, I said he collaborated in the porn industry. I didn't say he like was in a porn movie.
Oh, I'm sorry. I heard that wrong.
Do you remember there used to be a documentary in MTV called Porn to Rock instead of Born to Rock?
No, I don't.
So Porn to Rock was a documentary in MTV a long time ago that featured porn actors and actresses that were also musicians. The only one I remember is this one girl named India. I don't know why that one stood out.
Samantha
Fox,
maybe?
No, this was in the 90s. This was after. Okay. Yeah.
Tracy Lord. There you go.
Again, this was in the 90s, way later, and you're nowhere near your mic, Ernest, so nobody heard that. He said Tracy Lords. It doesn't matter. Nobody in that fucking documentary was popular. Like, we're not going to know any of these names. They were just porn stars who wanted to be musicians or tried to be musicians, failed, and then became porn stars.
Yeah.
Something along. Anyway, he collaborated in some of that. Whatever that was. I don't know. Right.
Wait a minute. That was the 90s.
I literally just said that.
We're talking
Tracy
about
Lords?
Yeah.
No, Tracy Lords was underage in the 80s.
Oh, what?
Shit. That's when she was doing porn.
Well,
when she was underage in the 80s.
I'm older than I thought.
Because Crybaby, the movie Crybaby, the John Waters movie Crybaby, was post her porn career, and that was in the late 80s.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, you know, that the 90s maybe opened up an opportunity for her to do music.
Did Tracy Lords do music?
I don't know.
We have no idea what we're talking about. Why do we even have a music podcast? We have no idea what we're saying 90% of the time.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, we'll cut that part out.
No, we won't.
We were holding hands and I'll never be the same. So, there we go. A lot of artists that got signed in the 80s, like Third Base, Public Enemy.
Public Enemy, yeah.
I mean, P. And I mean, that was something that Rick Rubin wanted to sign and become big. And Russell was like, nah, man, don't fuck with that. That's like hip-hop, punk rock stuff, man. We don't want to deal with that at all. And he said, no, man, listen, this is going to be dope. And they did. And I'm so glad that they did. Because P.E. is one of my biggest hip-hop icons and influences on my life, man.
The year was 1997.
Yep.
And Def Jam released, to me, one of the most important seminal fucking albums of all time. Right? Like, and this was Public Enemy's Yo Bum Rush the Show.
Yes.
I mean,
I was listening to that on vinyl as I was getting ready to come here today. And then on my way here, I was jamming out to Fear of a Black Planet. So, yeah.
Before Public Enemy, Chuck D and Flavor Flav, along with Hank and Keith Shockley, became also all part of Public Enemy, among other rappers that became super famous, had another project, our previous project. But out of that, they sort of came together to form Public Enemy. Obviously, the first album they released, which was, in their own words, directly influenced by Run DMC and the Beastie Boys. So Public Enemy openly said that, which I think is amazing because I didn't know that.
And you can hear it on the album, though. You can hear the samples that they used on the album. It's both. They used Led Zeppelin and Queen on that album. So, I mean, this is a sample. And it was produced by Rick Rubin.
Yeah, so they took those sort of like almost disharmonized samples and breaks.
Right.
Because you can't dance to this shit.
And it was completely something different. It was rebel music. It was rebel hip-hop music. It wasn't basic hip-hop where you're walking out there saying, you know, wave your hands in the air. You know, they were rapping about some serious shit, man. So
it was politically charged. It was anarchistic. It was rebellious. It was putting the plight of the black man in a country that where they've been sort of oppressed for, you know, most of its existence, and saying, hey, fuck you. We don't need to be nice about this shit anymore.
And there's
a Black Panthers approach with the S1Ws, which was, if you ever see the S1W, Security of the First World, is what that means.
Master Griff, after a while, became an asshole about that shit. But yeah.
But if you watch them, they're very militant in the way they're in the background dancing. It is fucking... You have Chuck D's insane talent. You have the S1Ws on the back and Terminator X, quote unquote, speaking with his hands.
Yes.
And then you have Flavor Flav. Which, I mean, look, I think Public Enemy would not be Public Enemy without Flavor Flav.
Right.
I just don't understand the connection.
Flavor Flav is an asshole. I met him. He's a dickhead. Chuck D is cool as fuck. But that was just my experience with him.
We're so popular. He's going to listen to this and it's going to.
Fuck you, Canceled. Flavor Flav.
Oh, my God.
We should have him on the podcast.
Well, I'll tell him to his face.
He's just this motherfucker.
No, we should still have him on the podcast.
Yeah, I'll tell him. Yeah, you're an asshole when I met you, so that's that. That's my interpretation of you.
At one point, he was dating the Russian woman from Rocky IV.
He had his own show, Flavor of Love, on fucking VH1 or whatever it was. It was the weirdest thing, though. Like, Flav up on stage is like, yo, we all have to get along, you know, fuck racism, we're all cool together, you know, you be nice to each other. He gets off stage, and I'm like, I'm talking not even a minute off stage. He walks off stage, and he walks up to me, and I'm like, yo, what's up, Flav? He's like, yo, fuck you, man. Okay.
Maybe the German woman didn't give him any German.
I was like, sorry, man, I don't know what the fuck I did, but I just said, hey. Chuck is like, yo, what's up, man? Chuck signed everything, took pictures of everybody, took a minute to talk to everybody, man. It's all right.
But you're not bitter about it.
Flavor was having a bad day. Table's
gonna fall over. I am not at all bitter about it. Anyways.
All right, so we're going to go back a little bit back in time here, because in 86, another one of my hip-hop rap superheroes came into Def Jam Recordings, and that was motherfucking Slick Rick.
You, yeah.
Slick Rick.
Lotta dolly. Lotta dolly.
Yeah. So Slick Rick came into Def Jam because Rick Rubin saw him in, somewhere in London, and he immediately offered him a contract, like, on the spot, right there and then. Slick Rick became part of the Def Jam family. Which, to me, you know, we talk about Dougie Fresh and all these other things. To me, the beginning of hip hop for me personally is Slick Rick. See, but I can't talk through this because this is,
you know what?
Like, I'm just going to sit here and listen to the whole thing.
You know what?
Lottie Dottie.
Lottie. Lottie Dottie, we likes the party. We don't cause trouble. We don't bother nobody. We're just a man upon the mic. And when we rock upon the mic, we rock the mic right.
Oh, that's y'all. Keeping y'all in health.
Just to see you smile and enjoy yourself. Cause it's
cool when you So I think most people are going to recognize this as a Snoop Dogg song.
Yes.
This is not a Snoop Dogg song. This is a Slick Rick song in Def Jam recording albums. Yeah, this is not a Snoop Dogg song. For all the very woke white girls who listen to hardcore gangsta rap now. Yeah, not a Snoop Dogg song.
No. Even though Snoop Dogg did do it justice.
Oh my God, he did. Yes. Absolutely. His voice and his how he's so lyrical, right? Snoop. Yes. He's so lyrical.
Even though he spells his name in every goddamn song he does. Yeah.
It carries this melodic weight.
Uh-oh.
But Slick Rick is the shit.
I love this song. This and children's song.
Yeah. When I was growing up and barely spoke English in southern Texas, I had three posters. I had a Metallica poster with Cliff Burton. I had an Ozzy Osbourne poster, Bark at the Moon. And I had a Slick Rick poster. And
oh,
that was
wow.
it. And that was
See,
it.
See, that's our podcast, though, man. That's, yeah. I mean, that's why we're all so such good friends. And like, we're all over the board, man.
How much you never know.
So anyways, tell us about Slick Rick, man.
Oh, yeah, so, sorry.
He was from...
I got lost track of so, Slick Rick is a British-American rapper. So, Rick actually went and saw him. I don't know if he specifically went and traveled to London to see him, but he discovered him playing in London or, you know, performing in London and, like, pretty much immediately offered him a contract. So that's how he joined the Def Jam, you know, family. This was in 1986, and
so that was a tad pissed. I mean, tad pissed.
That was what?
A tad passed over, like when they first started. So,
couple of years, yeah, a couple of years.
Which I mean,
it's like Rick
to keep adding talent to it. So,
yeah,
it's like Rick.
Yeah, so MC Ricky D is what he originally went by the way, not Slick Rick.
On and on and on, she kept on.
This is with Dougie Fresh. Yeah, this is Slick Rick and Dougie
live
Fresh.
Version. Yeah, yeah. But still, though.
So, actually, you know, in 80...
I know at some point he did some shit and got... deported back to his country and a bunch of other shit, but Slick Rick in my book's always top five.
So in this you know, this album, his actual album, The Great Adventures of Slick Rick, was released in 88, so a few years after Def Jam was already fairly established, and he did collaborate with Vance Wright in this one. So that was, you know, they were already collaborated before. This album was very successful in general. Hit number one Billboard's R&B hip hop chart, mm-hmm. which is fucking amazing. It also featured charting singles like "Children's Story," "Hey Young World," "Teenage Love,"
"Teenage Love." So, which was always like a down track, though. It's like, all
right, right.
First minute, you're like, yeah, I'm down with it. Like, yeah.
And I think what I love about Slick Rick, so a lot of rap and hip hop from the era was, you know, different things, but Slick Rick was a storyteller. Yeah. If you listen to any of his songs or all of his songs, yes. really, he's telling a story. There's a full story in every one of his songs. So, you know, I don't think that was predominant back then, and I think Slick Rick sort of made that happen. You're eating your fucking Cheetos in the middle of the podcast. Really?
You're talking right now, so I'm good.
That's all right. I'll mute him. Wow. That won't mute me.
The professionalism, people.
Hey,
the
man.
Professionalism.
I was hungry. Hey, some fucking kid came up and offered me.
That is Cheetos true. That is true. Some kid came up and told
this
us. This
Cheetos is for a good cause.
It is, yeah, man. So,
what, do you guys remember what good cause you supported?
Chester Cheetah. It was for some kid's school.
Disadvantaged program, youth.
Yeah, that was it.
No, it wasn't.
Yes, it was.
No. Yeah, it was. It was for their school band.
No. No, it was Disadvantaged Youth.
Yeah, it was.
That's really not an organization. Actually, you know what? Amber Heard, that is not an organization. Disadvantaged Youth is it's a concept. It's not an organization.
I didn't say it's an organization.
All right. What was it for then?
I don't know. I just gave him $6. I don't know.
You gave him $2.
That was a $6 bottle of 2 ounce Cheetos.
That's why he offered me more stuff. He's like, yeah, you want more Cheetos? No,
that's what he was talking about. He's talking about disadvantaged youth.
Yeah.
He's talking about helping out youth.
And he had pecan pie, and I said no.
Disadvantaged.
So I thought you only gave him $2.
So what happened?
Not that I'm going to eat pecan pie, you but I passed it up.
What he had to say.
I love this podcast. This is fun, dude. Hey, this is just us talking about fucking Def Jam recordings and drinking beers and being stupid, man.
Do you know what's happening right now?
I do. You are on Slick Rick, hey, man.
Cut the shit out. You know I have to edit all weekend now because we don't have an episode for Monday.
So, okay.
Hey.
Slick Rick.
Slick Rick.
All right. So that happened, and that was great.
Why did Slick Rick become part of Def Jam? There's one reason.
I don't know. Enlighten me.
The same reason Nice and Smooth and EPMD became part of Def Jam.
Which is?
Their label flopped.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Talk about it, because I don't know this.
Yes.
Oh, or not. Okay.
Their label flopped, and they... defaulted back to Def Jam. EPMD crossover. Yeah, we were. All right. So they're Nice and Smooth. Slick Rick, EPMD, their label flopped and folded. So they all defaulted. I don't know how or why. They all defaulted back to Def Jam. I wish I could drink that beer. They all defaulted back to Def Jam, and they all became Def Jam artists. So in that midst of things, we also had one of my favorite of all times, which I'm not afraid to admit is... third base.
See, here's the thing. I think we should do a whole episode on third base. Because I know one fucking song.
Because you know what, though? Oh, you all right.
Yeah. Pop Goes the Weasel. I love it. It's one of my favorite songs. No, I love it.
Def Jam and third base. I know the Cactus album and Derek's dialect front to back.
Right.
They are one of my favorite hip-hop acts of all time. I know I'm alone, and I swear to God.
No, you're not. I love third base.
I know one other guy on this planet that knows third base as well as I do. And I used to be in a rap group with him back home.
Wait, you used to be in a rap group?
Jim Gibbs. I was in a... yes, I was.
Oh, that just opened up Pandora's box.
It did. We were called Menace to Society.
Oh, how original.
Yeah, I know. I was a DJ. We had a guy named George Bartholomew and Jim Gibbs. We call him Barf. And because
What was Bartholomew's stage name? What's the Bartholomew? Because that was the greatest stage name ever.
Yeah, it was, but behind the scenes we called him Barf. And then Jim Gibbs, who's our main MC. He went hardcore Christian, and we kind of broke up after that. But prior to that, though, we were killing it with. We did like a battle of the bands once or twice. I mean, we won, but we didn't know what the hell we were doing. I was a DJ in the background. We had a guy playing drums. No one could hear me over the drums, so I was back to scratch and doing whatever bullshit. But Menace Society, yeah. Jim man. Gibbs, if you're listening, man, call me. We need to talk.
You do have to pay for autographs, Gibbs.
Yes. Yeah. I try.
So I think, you know, part of our... Oh, now you got Slam. I think that's more going into the 90s.
No. You know what? This is the perfect transition because Def Jam kind of faded out in the late 80s.
Right.
And they didn't resurge till the 90s with like Redman and Onyx, which Jam Master J found Onyx. This album, actually, I listened to this album today and I forgot how fucking awesome this album was.
Oh, Back the Fuck Up? Yeah.
Back the Fuck Up. God damn, this album's a shit, dude.
Back the Fuck Up is amazing. But that was all they did, right? Like, kind of like the Fush Nickens.
Right. Last time I was in Repo, I wouldn't call Onyx a one-hit wonder. If you tell them after their face, they might punch you.
Because they never actually had a hit.
Slam was awesome.
They had a popular song.
But this whole album.
To be a one-hit wonder, you have to hit a number one chart.
But this whole album was fucking phenomenal. Redman. It's funny because everyone thinks Redman was part of Wu-Tang. And he wasn't.
He never was. No.
He never was. He was always on Def Jam, Wu-Tang. I think we're on the same label as Run DMC, Priority. I think. I could be wrong. Don't quote me on that. Look it up. All right. Let's wrap this up.
All right. So yeah.
Was going to be only the early days of Def Jam. So we've started in the 90s.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I think hip-hop changed a lot in the 90s, too.
It did. It certainly did.
Like, there's a very finite sound of 80s hip-hop and 90s hip-hop.
Yes.
There's a slight transition that you can see with bands that, or groups.
There was shit that came out in the 90s that was still relevant in the 80s. People are like, yo, man, that shit's whack. We want something new. So Def Jam had to change their whole profile on how they recorded hip-hop, which was Onyx, which was Domino, which was Nice and Smooth. That shit all came out in the 90s, and it changed it. It was still Rick Rubin recording new beats, but at the same time, there was other producers, which I don't even know their names.
Yeah, well, eventually Rubin left. So here's the thing is, you know, we want to do this Def Jam Origins sort of episode. You know, Def Jam has gone on to become a massive media conglomerate, releasing not only records and music, but releasing comedy specials, releasing TV specials, releasing video games. You know, they've become a media company. They've outgrown Eric and Russell's original Eric. You fucking Rick Rubin.
I look like Rick.
Rick.
That's Rick okay. And Russell's original vision, right? Because their original vision really was.
As it should. I mean, you don't want to stick with the same shit all the time.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it became its own monster, right? And they've gone on to become these, you know,
it's still around today. Yeah. So, you know, you had Jay-Z, which eventually took over, and he gave like their own branches to like DMX and
we'll cover that.
Fat Joe. Yeah. And all. Yeah, yeah. We will get to that stuff, but I'm saying Def Jam became a huge monster that we need to do justice to be able to do this. Yeah,
I think that was
right
one of the things. When we started doing research for the episode, I think eventually we're just going to do...
It's over 40 years of Def Jam music, man.
We do want to cover record labels. For example, one of my passions is going to be K Records. Right? And I want to do... Yeah. K Records is not going to take 3 months worth of research.
Murder, Inc. Records.
Discord. Metal Blade. There's a lot. But I think that when we decided to do a Def Jam episode, we didn't realize the magnitude of the project. And so now we're going to have to segment it out into probably at least three episodes. 80s, probably, 90s, yeah. 2000s. But at least I think we feel like we did a good sort of good overall origin story,
yes,
so to speak.
I think it was great.
There's a couple things we missed. Look out for the playlist. We are going to release a playlist. I think it's going to have a lot more songs than what we talked about today.
I'm going to do the day this comes
out. Oh, yes, please.
The day this is put out on Spotify, I will do from my home, Def Jam turntable set of all Def Jam early artists. I have a catalog of unspeakable Def Jam artists from Salsa.
Yeah, so we'll release the episode that morning, that evening, around 7 p.m.
Yep.
Go to our social media. We are definitely going to do a live spinning with DJ Eric.
DJ Easy.
Easy. He's going to be doing a lot of Def Jam recordings. It should be fun.
EPMD, third base, shit like that. So,
hope you liked the episode. On top of that, please follow us on all social media at MBives Podcast everywhere. We do have a Linktree page. But again, follow us on social media.
If you have any episode requests or questions about our episodes, please hit us up, let us know, we'll be happy to answer you guys. We are all linked to our podcast site, so
yeah, the email is mbizepodcast@gmail.com.
all right,
thank you guys,
goodbye.